And we have our first guest that is joining us on the line. Isn't that so? Okay.
It is. We're really excited because Andrew has written a great piece for The Intercept about the fatal shooting of Walter Scott. And I just wanted to, before we get into that story, and we're going to actually, before we get into the discussion of Andrew's excellent article, we're going to do something I think that's pretty interesting. I don't know if you saw this, Andrew, but the Huffington Post released a fake news story, which is how... Basically, what they did is they wrote up what the Walter Scott story would have looked like had we only had the testimony of the police officer. In other words, this is what the news would have reported had we not had the video taken by the bystander. Then what happened is on MSNBC, they made a video of this. So again, this is what... Again, in the deadly shooting of Walter Scott, as our listeners probably know, there was video released by a bystander that totally contradicts what the policeman said who actually shot him. And this kind of highlights the importance of video and kind of, you know, highlights the dishonesty in so many police departments. So this is what we're going to listen to now, is the news as it would have been told had we not seen the video released by the bystander.
A routine traffic stop turned deadly Saturday when police say a North Charleston officer was forced to open fire on a driver who tried to overpower him. It began when Officer Michael Slager pulled over 50-year-old Walter Scott for a broken taillight, and Scott suddenly fled the scene. Slager said he pursued Scott, and his lawyer told a local newspaper, when confronted, Officer Slager reached for his taser, as trained by the department, and then a struggle ensued. The driver tried to overpower Officer Slager in an effort to take his taser. Police say Scott was able to gain control of the taser, and that feeling threatened, Slager then reached for his gun and opened fire. Scott was hit and fell to the ground.
Shots fired. Subject is down. He grabbed my taser.
Police say other officers rushed to the scene, delivering first aid and performing CPR. Scott was pronounced dead at the scene. Walter Scott has a long rap sheet that includes charges of assault and battery and failure to pay child support. In a statement, North Charleston Police Chief Eddie Drigger said, "This is part of the job that no one likes and wishes would never happen. This type of situation is unfortunate and difficult for everyone."
Remember, everything you saw there was based entirely only on the information that was released by the police after the incident. The only way we could have covered the story without the video. And so what we learned once the video was released, of course, was a very different story. Walter Scott was running away when he was shot. He was shot in the back. That no CPR was performed, and it actually isn't clear at all that Walter Scott grabbed the officer's taser. Let me bring in the panel.
So that, again, was, as you heard, was a fake news story that would have been reported had we not seen the video contradicting the policeman, police officers telling of the story. So, Andrew, can you tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write your article in The Intercept, which is called "Video of Shooting Caught Police Propaganda Machine in Action"?
Sure. And just one quick question. Was that a joint thing where Huffington Post made that and MSNBC made the video? Or just
no, I don't think so. I think Huffington Post did it and then MSNBC made it inspired by the news, by the way that they had done it. I actually did HuffPost Live last week, and Andrew Corelli from Mediaite referenced the same story. So I think that was a pretty interesting take on it. It's kind of like The Onion, but The Onion meets tragedy and actual reality.
Yeah, well, you know, my perspective on when I wrote my article and just thinking about it was definitely along those same lines, because when the video came out Tuesday, before that happened, I actually didn't know anything about this story from last Saturday, because the original incident happened last Saturday. And with so much news floating around, this definitely wasn't on the surface of mainstream surface. This was basically relatively a local story that just was up to, down to North Charleston, that maybe had filtered through some black circles overall in regards to what happened, but it was still on that local level, since it seemed to follow the same pattern overall and the same tragic death of another black life towards police shooting. So when that video came out on Tuesday, what really compelled me to right, this one was in regards to the same narrative that we always hear, and what the video showed us, and then what the cop, Officer Slager, told his precinct and told his story overall, and then his precinct, what they told to the newspaper, the Post and the Courier, and to media outlets that he feared for his life. Basically, this is something that he really needed to use his gun for. This was his only resort, and that this is what had to be. And you saw in regards to how that narrative was just taken at full value, or just taken in regards to giving the clout, because relatively what it is that despite any evidence that may be against this action of Raw, that since there was no witness, or even if there is witness of Raw, since there's no definitive video or no concrete video of Raw, that you would always believe what the cop says, and that it's going to be difficult to prove that what he or she says is untrue to what they had to use on their force. So that's what really compelled me to really write it, in regards to showing like how that narrative and that propaganda gets served, that they can have generate because they have the authority of a cop to say what they say is the truth, and that it is hard to refute unless you clearly have video evidence showing that that is not the case and that they fully lied.
Right. And just to, so everyone knows this, so the officer Slager has been charged. This is what makes this story kind of unique, right? Because we had the Eric Garner, we had the Michael Brown. Those are just two of the most well-known incidents of unarmed black men being killed by white police. And those, of course, were pretty outrageous in themselves, and then extra outrageous because they didn't even get indicted. What I find very important about this story, and I don't know, and you guys can talk about this too, we're finally seeing someone charged, is people have kind of very little faith in body cams, and they kind of dismiss them. Oh, it's not enough. Oh, it's not going to do anything because, look, we had the video of Eric Garner, and that didn't matter. And I was kind of concerned about that because I thought that that was not, like, the most productive takeaway from this. So to me, it's very exciting. It's inspiring to see that something actually happened as a result of video.
Well, you know, the thing with how a lot of cops were and a lot of officers overall were trying to be a little leery about the body cameras, because we know in terms of the obvious reasons that we would see what they're doing on a daily and whether what they said was true and what they believe. I think a lot of public skepticism in regards to body cameras in the past, or even in the recent past up to the Tulsa shooting, was the fact that they believed that the police departments would doctor video, would show the whole video. Now, that would be incredibly dumb of them to do, considering the many FOIA requests, and then people recognizing that certain video would have a jump cut and realizing that, wait a minute, there's an edit to this video. This edit doesn't have a continuous pattern. Something's weird here. So that was really, I think, the only concern for a lot of people overall, because financially, honestly, It should be well in line in regards to having enough body cameras overall for a lot of officers. Now, in terms of doing the budget for that, that is timely, but then you see how many cars that are used that police buy, and then guns that are used that police buy, and other stuff overall. So if they can buy these other means of equipment, that they can surely have body cameras, especially in this era. And if they have a dashboard camera on their car, then surely they can have a body camera overall. So I think this has been at least tempered down. And you already see Bill Branton. He's had like a little bit of a almost reverse on this, because he was a little leery about this before in regards to body cameras. But since the Scott video, and I haven't seen any reaction you said on the Tulsa stuff yet, but he said it's a game changer. So I think the climate in regards to viewing body cameras is slightly shifted now. And I think for me and my perspective, and your perspective, I think that's encouraging to see.
Right.
Well, if we step back nationally for a second, going over to San Francisco, they just had the scandal of San Francisco police officers engaging in pretty severe racial hate speech, white power talk, racially degrading talk against blacks, Filipinos.
It's equal opportunity racism, though. It's inspiring.
Well, against everyone, but whites in that case.
Right, of course.
And, I mean, we're bouncing around Tulsa, Ferguson, San Francisco, New York. Beyond just sort of transparency about it, it's not a secret the level of social violence happening, specifically against black communities. How much transformation of the training of police needs to be going on? I mean, why is this scandal? Why can't this be brought to heel?
Look, as far as I'm concerned, it's not going to be about the training of police unless and until we in this country have a national dialogue, and I mean a protracted dialogue about race and race-related issues. These things are going to continue to happen again and again and again, and no amount of police cameras, no amount of police trainings are going to stop those things, because the deep, as you just pointed out, Jed, and in San Francisco with this hate speech, and if you look here in New York City, the police blogs now are lighting up with all kinds of virulent, I mean, you know, anti-black, anti-immigrant talk. So until those things happen, I'm afraid these things will continue to happen. Maybe not. I don't know what maybe not, but they're going to continue to happen, I'm afraid.
Andrew, you wrote about how feared for my life, quote unquote, has become a crutch for law enforcement in cases where an officer has used deadly force.
Yeah, that's a good point that you raise, Andrew.
Especially deadly force against people of color, and not just law enforcement, as we saw with the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case.
Right.
Random wing
nut. And men, especially black men.
Runs around with a gun, shoots a teenage boy, and he talks about how he fears for his life after stalking this kid.
Right.
And you say it sort of serves as a Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice chant, right? There is no deadly weapon in the hands of the person just killed. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, you've seen too many cases over not only the last year, but throughout the course of the last, you could even say 100 and even more, in regards to how someone could be clearly unarmed. And you as a cop, or if you're properly trained as a cop, that you only use deadly force when you really have to use deadly force in other means. If someone is really threatening your life and has a gun right back and shot first or whatnot. And clearly, this has not been the case in regards to these recent killings that we've seen and many others. And yet, it's always used in regards to the main excuse that a cop has to use whenever he or she, well, most relatively he, because I haven't seen any females in regards to, you know, murdering any, like, regular black guys overall, but it's in regards to how they would then use that as a just the obvious way to say, okay, you know what, let me think of the best way I can have an excuse for how this man is on the ground dead at my hands.
Right.
And it's just, is reiterated almost in every time you see a line. Whether we saw that with the John Crawford case in Dayton, Ohio, or Tamir Rice being 12 years old in Cleveland, and seeing the video on both, and you see the lack of, if we didn't have video on neither, you would have thought that they were both belligerent, and you see with a 12-year-old being belligerent in regards to that, and seeing big police officers with guns and whatnot, and the absurdity thinking about that, but it would have been no video seen about it. And it's their confidence in regards to using that line and thinking that, okay, if I use that line, nothing's going to happen to me. My precinct or my department is going to protect me. And that's just constantly used.
It seems like there's this, I mean, dependent on the idea that the black, especially black male body, is kind of inherently dangerous. There's this criminalization of just black bodies. Like Darren Wilson talk about how Michael Brown had a demon-like quality, right? And then you heard Ben Stein, the scary commentator / star of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, talk about how he was armed with his incredibly scary self, right? It's almost as if the weapon is just the actual body. To me, this really speaks to some kind of, you know, deep racist, obviously.
Well, yeah, it's just that continued perspective of how they view black girls and black men and black women as well, too.
Right.
In regards to, you know, these heinous acts and then to try to justify it in regards to using the whole stereotypical labels that they placed on us for years and years and years.
And have you, as a young African-American man in New York City, have you encountered this kind of these kinds of stereotypes at all? With, I don't know, have you had any interactions with, you know, NYPD or?
It shows you how absurd the climate is. That I have to say that I'm lucky that it hasn't gone to the level of how my cousins have like endured it. And mind you, I have an uncle that's actually been a detective, though he's a detective in New Jersey for just Port Authority stuff, but it was more cracking down on white-collar crime, though, and stuff. So that was the ironic thing about it. But the thing about it that's so ironic is that one summer, I'm an avid runner. I like to jog a lot, too. And I'm just jogging down my block in the Bedford-Stuyvesant part of Brooklyn, which has been notoriously black for so many, or black for so many years overall, but then notoriously stereotyped as being, like, incredibly, like, always hood and not having many families, where it's a lot of family communities there overall. And what happens is I'm just jogging down the block one summer, and a cop car goes the other direction and actually, like, stops me and whatnot in regards to trying to ask me where I was going. You know, thinking that I was running away from a crime or something. Now, I wasn't even running that fast. I was just literally jogging. I'm not running at Usain Bolt speeds or whatever. I'm just relatively jogging in my community. And I had to say, no, I'm going to the local Y to just get on my workout or whatnot. And then they didn't say sorry or anything. Just drove by, and I just jogged by. And I had my do-rag on at the same time, too. So that also probably enticed it as well. So, yeah, I had that moment right there in regards to that. I had, like, a little weird cop behavior in regards to certain conversations with them. But luckily for me, outside of that, random incident, I've been lucky enough to not have to endure absurd cop behavior on me.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I couldn't help but thinking of you getting almost pulled over for running while or jogging while black, JWB.
You know, listen, Andrew, you know what that is? It is the same thing. It's very, very similar to where are you going without your pass? Remember that? Mm-hmm. Remember that? Yeah. Many, many years ago. I don't remember it. I mean, it wasn't in my life and it wasn't in your life. Nobody here. But that was years ago. Where are you going without your pass? And you're running too?
Right.
Yeah, I gotta tell you real quick. Like my mom tells me every day since like I was 13, 14, when I had a chance to get ID, like to always bring your ID no matter where you go.
No matter.
And it's a shame, but that's what I have to do because of stuff like that.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you. And where can we find you on Twitter, Andrew?
Absolutely.
You can just find me on Twitter at SluggerJails, SuggerJails, SluggerJails. You'll find me there and. Sure, it will keep the conversation going there.
Thank you so much.